We are delighted now to introduce our second keynote speaker. And I didn't ask in advance, but I'm going to assume it's pronounced Freya. And I'm sure that she'll let us know if I said that wrong. And I believe Freya is coming to us from Colorado. So shout out to the Rocky Mountains. And Freya will speak for 35 minutes. Thank you, Freya.
Oh, thank you, Eileen. Oh, thank you so much. My name is Freya, perfectly pronounced, and I am in Colorado and so honored to be with you here today. Thank you for the invitation. And I just got to say the word keynote really messes with my ego. So, but when I look at your faces and I just, you know, we're just all in this room and we're all fellow compulsive eaters, that's very grounding for me. So is someone going to be timing me or should I keep track of the time? I don't have a problem with that, but
I'll give you a 5 minute warning.
Okay, perfect. I'm just going to set my timer so that I have some sense of where I am. So if you hear it going off, that's what it is. So I'd love to just start with a prayer. Higher power, thank you for this space. Thank you for bringing us all together virtually to speak the language of the heart together. And thank you for this opportunity to share this journey. And I trust that you will use this to be useful in some way or another. Amen. All right, well, Eileen, I love that you just started with that reading from For Today. It was really powerful because it, one of my beliefs, it says, you know, I affirm that I have within me all I need to live an abstinent, sober life. And that is one of my beliefs, you know, that if I, this program is all about finding a higher power. And if I really have a higher power, that higher power is not going to put me in a situation where I cannot be abstinent. I mean, those things just, that just doesn't compute. So I get to do the footwork, but I have to start from the assumption that it's possible. It's absolutely possible. So I wanted to, when I was invited to speak, one suggestion was to talk a little bit about the steps that we had gone over this morning, particular steps 4 and 5. So I do plan to talk a bit about that, but I also would, you know, just want to share some of my story. So just a full disclosure, I have a lot of notes about steps 4 and 5. I don't have a lot of notes about my story. So we'll see what part of it comes out this morning. We'll just see what higher power wants. So let's see. I did actually, I wanted to start with today's page in For Today, which is the little white meditation book, and it's May 15th. And I thought it was very appropriate to the topic, particularly of steps 4 and 5, which are, you know, the beginning of what we call the action steps. And the quote is a Russian proverb. It says, "Pray to God, but continue to row to shore. God is not my arms and legs. It is up to me to do the footwork. Ours is a program of action. The first two steps require reflection and contemplation. The rest call for direct action. Of course, I do not work a perfect program. When I feel rebellious, as I sometimes do, then I pray to be willing, putting myself and my stubbornness in God's hands. Out of old programming, I still need to be perfect before I can like myself. But God has infinite and unconditional love for me and gives me everything I need, including the willingness to take action. I have but to ask. So for today, God does for me what I cannot do for myself, not what I can do." And that's the conclusion of the reading. I just thought it was such a perfect reminder that, yes, I participate in this program. I prepare, I take the steps, you know, I do the actions, but I'm not making any of it happen. So that's really, really important to me, especially when I do things that feel impossible, such as, you know, a thorough house cleaning and inventory and then sharing it with someone else and then making the amends. So I'll come back to that. So I'm going to just share some of my story and then I'll talk a little bit more about the steps. So I came into OA young. I had always known about it. You know, it felt like that was the kind of household that I grew up in. My, you know, my stepmom attended OA off and on. And it was just part of my family culture, this awareness of 12-step programs. Like when you have some sort of addiction, this is where you go. So there was part of me that knew from a very early age, I did not have a normal relationship with food. And, you know, I remember as a, you know, 5-year-old, like noticing my body and just feeling like I was kind of chubby and feeling very ashamed of it. And I was also very aware that food seemed to do something for me. Like I had this heightened interest and awareness around food that I don't think other people had. And I learned very early on to be ashamed of that as well. Like I just felt like this, it's not okay for me to eat as much as I want to eat, or even to tell other people that I want to eat that much. So I describe it sometimes as like a spidey sense. Like I had this like extra sense. Like I knew it was in the house. I knew it was in the cupboards. I knew it was on your plate. I knew it was on my plate. I, you know, like I knew it was left over. So, I mean, in another area that could have been a really useful skill, but for me, it, you know, it was just part of my disease. So, as I grew, it was really the perfect, recipe for bulimia because I had that desire for the extra food. And then I had this clear knowledge, like that is not okay. Like that is so shameful. So, I did become bulimic in high school and I was never, you know, like my story is not one of extremes. I was never extremely overweight, extremely underweight. I was, you know, I wasn't binging and purging like 20 times a day, but it was bad enough, you know, like that it, I didn't, and combined with knowing, you know, like some part of me knew that this was not right. You know, that I think that maybe helped me to try to, that I got the way that my disease really manifested was I'm going to control this, you know, cause I knew this was not right. And so I have to manage this. I have to stay on top of it. And that is no less the disease than flat out, you know, binging and purging and, you know, gaining hundreds of pounds, just the control is how it came out for me. So I was no less insane, even though it was easy to deny because it was easy to look at my life and think, well, everything's pretty good. You know, it's okay. I just had this occasional thing I do with food, you know, and then all of the denial and shame around it. So it was such a godsend to, you know, I knew when I came to my first meeting when I was 19, and I'll share my, you know, for what me then was the hitting bottom experience that actually got me into a meeting was I had known about Away. I'd actually had women come and I went to boarding school. They came and spoke to the girls in my dormitory about their experiences and about the solution in OA. And I just like sat in through that, you know, through that meeting, not the OA meeting, but the meeting with these women, like just, oh my gosh, I hope, just trying to keep a straight face. I hope nobody is looking at me. These women, like they came for me. How did they find out? And I did take one of their numbers and, you know, didn't call it, of course, but, you know, secretly snuck that number. So I had it so that when I was ready, I knew where to go. And my hitting bottom experience was, I was home at my parents' house for a holiday break. And I remember eating, I don't know how you guys feel about mentioning certain foods, but I was eating certain food. It was a box of crackers. And I realized like, I'm going to eat this until it's gone. And then I'm going to throw it up and I don't want to, you know, just that moment of I'm going to do this. It's not fun. This is, you know, I don't want to be doing this and I can't stop. And so that's what got me into my first OA meeting. And I, you know, immediately knew that I was home. I knew it was such a relief to be admitting like these are people who are doing what I do and I don't have to pretend that I don't do it anymore. So that was just such a wonderful gift. And I was 19 years old. So what I was really interested in was I really wasn't interested in the steps. I wasn't interested in the spiritual awakening. I really loved the fellowship and I really loved, you know, what I heard was food plan and fellowship and tools. So that's what I did, you know, like I'm sure they were talking about the steps. I got this wonderful sponsor who was very gentle, very kind, and who had a lot of experience. And I remember her suggesting, recommending, you know, like kind of prodding me gently into like, let's do these steps. And I kind of just wanted to be a good girl and people please her. So I, you know, just did my best. Like I wasn't interested in them for myself, but I thought, okay, she's suggesting them, I'll try it. But what I really got was, I love the fellowship, I can identify, and I'll use these tools and I'll follow this food plan. And the first food plan I had, actually, I mentioned that control piece. I was so good at not eating too much that I learned to eat too little. So I actually learned to restrict early on in OA. And I thought that I had arrived. I just thought, this is it. I know I'm not eating too much. This is the best thing that ever happened to me. And everything's great until a family member expressed concern that, you know, I was looking unhealthy. And I was, that was a big one for me, because I thought that the best thing that could happen to me is that I would be too thin. And lo and behold, I was still, I was not well. You know, thin is not well. And I had to experience it in order to find out that I was just as crazy and obsessed about my body in a too thin body as in an overweight body or in a normal size body. Whoop. That's my first 10 minutes. So that was kind of a bummer, because I lived, you know, I could no longer believe the delusion that this is about the food. And if we fix the food and we fix the body stuff, then everything else is going to fall into place. So thank God I kept coming back. I never wanted to leave. And I continued in the program. You know, I went to a nutritionist, I got to a healthy weight. I continued, still not really interested in the steps, but I knew that they were, I had heard often enough that was an important part. So I was willing to at least try it. And throughout those, you know, those early years in recovery, I did a lot of things. I, graduated, I went through college, graduated college. I, moved around a little bit. I, got married. I moved across the country with my husband and, you know, did various jobs and, had a couple, you know, had two kids. So there was a lot that happened, and I'm so glad that I was in recovery. But I had also lived in the delusion that being in recovery meant that I was going to be immune from life, that I would, you know, I would not make any of the mistakes that other people made, that I would have it figured out, that I would have a corner on life. And so there, not a lot of humility there, and a lot of unrealistic expectations, and not a lot of God, I have to say. Like I wasn't aware. I mean, I say this with total love and compassion, but looking back, I can see how there was a lot of self-will there. But because the food was not the problematic thing, it wasn't calling my name, I didn't understand exactly what the problem was. You know, like, well, the food's okay, so I must be okay. But I experienced restlessness, irritability, and discontentment. And thank God I kept coming to meetings, and I was able to hear, as I was open to hearing more of the message, I started to hear what people had been probably saying all along. And so hearing what they were saying about the steps and about God, and particularly what I heard, you know, was about the big book, that there's this answer in the big book. And I being, you know, recognizing that I was living in long-term abstinence, but I was restless, irritable, and discontent, really opened my mind and made me willing. And I, you know, got a sponsor who had what I wanted and asked her, you know, will you take me through the big book? Because I love the OA literature, but I had always looked at the big book like, well, that's not for me. I'm not an alcoholic. You know, like I had read it, but I read it like with the intention, I didn't read it with any intention of identifying in. I read it as a story or like, oh, that's interesting. You know, like interesting stuff for those alcoholics, huh? You know, like, but it doesn't apply to me. So going through the big book was very transformational. And I don't think it was the big book itself combined with where I was in my life. Like I was ready to hear it. So the difference is, like, let's see, I guess the part that I started to identify with was that it has this strong language And I had really felt like, well, I'm not that bad. So this strong language doesn't apply to me. Like this progressive illness, like, no, I arrested that illness. So I'm, you know, I don't have those problems. And it, again, it took a lot of humility to recognize, like, actually all this stuff applies to me. And the I love page 38 in the big book. It's in the chapter More About Alcoholism, one of my favorite chapters. It says at the bottom, some of you are thinking, yes, what you tell us is true, but it doesn't fully apply. We admit we have some of these symptoms, but we have not gone to the extremes you fellows did, nor are we likely to. For we understand ourselves so well after what you have told us that such things cannot happen again. We have not lost everything in life through drinking, and we certainly do not intend to. Thanks for the information. And that was my attitude, was thanks for this information. I'm not going to do that. You know, like I've got this thing outsmarted, like I told you guys before. And so reading that in here and thinking I could have written this was like a big, you know, hit between the eyes of like, maybe this really is about me. And the more I read with the intention to identify in, the more that I found it speaking to me. So I think now I've gone through the steps in the big book, I think 4 times. I just completed my 4th time, and I get more and more every time. It's amazing. So I do want to speak about abstinence. Try not to spend too long on that, but abstinence felt pretty easy for me, like because my disease was so much about control, it was easy for me to stick to a food plan. I was like, I got this. I'm going to weigh and measure it. I'm going to do it right. I'm, you know, the perfectionist and the controller really thrived on that. But I wasn't, you know, I wasn't obsessed with my food being perfect, but, the same sponsor who took me through the big book the first time, she really challenged me. She said, you know, write down a really clear definition of abstinence, both the foods and the behaviors, so that you know when you've broken your abstinence. And so I wrote it down. And one of the behaviors for me was no second helpings, you know, like just a little bit more is a very dangerous place. It doesn't really matter what the food is. And then one night I had, you know, just eaten dinner, served dinner to my family, and there were just a couple bites of the food left. And I, without even thinking about it, just was like, oh, I'll eat that. You know, I'll eat those last few bites. And then later, as I was cleaning up, it occurred to me, like, I think I just took a second helping. You know, like, I don't think that I can call that abstinence. So I called my sponsor. I just was honest about what had happened. And she gave me some wonderful suggestion of, you know, pray about it for 3 days, talk to 3 people who you respect, and then see what answer God gives you, you know? And so the answer I got was, that's not abstinent. I don't want to call that abstinent. And it was a blow. And it was also a relief because I had, you know, 7+ years of abstinence at the time. And it meant I had just volunteered to chair a convention. I had, you know, I was working with sponsees, and breaking my abstinence meant that I had to let go of all of that. So it was a significant, moment for me to just admit, like, I'm not special, you know, like I'm not immune. I have this disease and I'm back on day one. So the beauty of that, once I got clear, was that I got to just focus on myself. You know, I got to let go of this idea of I have all this abstinence, I have all these sponsees, I'm doing all this service. And I just got to be, you know, Freya, fellow compulsive eater, bozo on the bus with like 24 hours of abstinence and one day at a time, the abstinence built up, and now it's been about 2.5 years, but it allowed me to, go through the steps in a new way with a new humility and really recognizing I had been doing so much on self-will, and now, self-will can only get me so far. It works for a while, but sooner or later I need this higher power. So I'm really, really grateful for that evolving journey. And let's see, I think I'm ready to transition into talking about steps 4 and 5. So, and there's so much that I can say about this. I will see how it goes with the timing, but these steps that I wasn't very interested in the beginning are so transformational. That is what this is about. The fellowship is so important. I can't do it without the fellowship, but I cannot use the fellowship to replace a higher power. Like that's, and that is what I was doing. You know, no food plan and no fellowship can replace what I need a higher power to do for me. It might work for a while, but long term, I need a God that is everything. So, looking at step four, I want to start back with step one, because I've been taught that the steps, we do the steps in order, and we do them. And for me, I do them the way they're outlined in the big book, and they're very clearly outlined, but I need somebody with some experience to help me to see how they're outlined. So I, I can't differentiate the true from the false. I need a recovered person's help. So if I have done step one, which the big book is very, very heavy on step one. There's like three chapters devoted to step one. It feels like it takes forever to get through, but that's because I need to have a very, very unshakably firm foundation in step one. I have to really grasp my powerlessness. That's me. Sorry about that. I have to know if I'm going to be properly motivated to do these steps with thoroughness and honesty and diligence and willingness, I have to be really convinced that I need to do it. And that's what step one does for me. Step one tells me there is no other way. You know, like I have tried so many other things, and even though it seemed to be working for a while, in the long run, it has not produced a satisfactory result. So that leads me to step two, which is if I'm really convinced that I can't do this, am I willing to believe that there is some power that can do it for me? And I used to think step two was, I have it all figured out. I'm besties with my higher power. I can tell you everything about my higher power. And now I've come to see that step two is a process. Step two is just that I'm willing to believe that there is a power out there. And then in step 11 and the rest of the steps, I'm encouraged to get to know that power. So I used to think I can't move on from step two until I have higher power figured out. And thank God that is not the case for me today. And then as a natural progression from, if I know I can't do it, and then I believe that a power can, step three follows naturally, which is I'm willing to let this power work in my life. So, and then four follows naturally from that, which is if I have, I'm sorry, I'm trying to decipher my notes. Oh, step four, doing step four is how we carry out our step three commitment. And I'm going to be referencing the OA 12 and 12. I love this piece of literature. And I'm going to be referencing the big book of AA. So on page 27 of the OA 12 and 12, it says very clearly, it says, this inventory, meaning the fourth step inventory, and the rest of the steps are the implementation of our step three commitment. Because I feel like it's easy to get confused about how do I do step three? How do I turn my will and my life over? And this is telling me you do it by doing the rest of the steps. Simple, it's just, you just take the direction. So that kind of takes the pressure off. But when I continue, if I just take these directions and continue with this inventory, that's my step three. That means I'm living out step three. Let's see. Oh, it talks, this book, the OA 12 and 12 talks about different methods, and there are some different methods for doing it, but I have found the big book to be the way that, that has worked really clearly for me. And it's not, intuitive. Like the things that I read in the big book about, like, first write about your resentments. I was like, well, why would I do that? How is that going to help me here? So I had to just do it because I was told to do it at first, and then, and later it became clear. So I'm going to talk about that a little bit. So in the big book, it talks about, there's three parts to the inventory. There's the resentments, the fears, and then there's sex conduct. And the resentments are talked about on page 64 in the big book. It says, it talks about resentments are our number one offender. And it says, we have been spiritually sick. And when the spiritual malady is overcome, we straighten out mentally and physically. And someone shared this idea with me that really helped. It's, you know, to understand my disease, I need to understand I have a physical allergy, which is when I ingest certain substances or certain behaviors, I react in an abnormal way that makes me want more or makes me want to behave in another crazy way, like purging my food. Thank you. That's my 5 minutes. Okay. And I also have a mental obsession,
you have 10 minutes. I'm sorry.
Oh, okay.
I was early. Yeah. Sorry about that.
Appreciate that. I have the mental obsession that tells me I can go back and I can pick that stuff up. It's not going to hurt me this time. And even when it's down, I come up with some crazy idea to pick it up again. So I have the physical allergy, the mental obsession. I also have a spiritual malady and I can't see, which just means something is not right with my spiritual status. And I can't see the spiritual malady the same way that I can't see the wind, but the resentments are the result of the spiritual malady. So the same way that I can see the wind blowing through the trees and I know it's there, it's like when I look at my resentments, I'm seeing what the spiritual malady does to my life. So the resentment inventory is one really useful tool to find out what's going on with my spiritual status. Because in the resentment inventory, I look at who I'm resentful towards. And then I let the spiritual malady talk. You know, I list out why am I pissed off at them? What did they do to me? And then I turn the corner. And this is so powerful. In the third column, I get to find out what are my instincts that are triggered? Why am I so upset that my son is using that disrespectful tone? Oh, it's because I feel disrespected. I feel insecure. I'm afraid that means that I'm not worthy or I'm not a good parent. And so it really is about me. That's what I find out in the third column. And in the fourth column, I'm invited to look at it from an entirely different angle. It says, you know, like I can keep focusing on what other people did to me and I can stay stuck and sore and in my disease, or I can disregard what they did. You know, I'm not saying they didn't do anything to me, I'm not saying they were right, but I look at them as a sick person, just like me, like they are spiritually sick. And I love it, especially with my kids. I don't even use the word sick person. It's like, this is an 8-year-old, you know, like they are developmentally exactly where they're supposed to be. And it works with my husband too. I just, you know, rather than even saying he's a sick person, I say he's a human. You know, like this is a human just like me. And we all have our moments of spiritual sickness. And I'm invited to take a kindly and tolerant view of every person and then look at what are the things that I, you know, what are the things that I, like when I'm not so focused on what they did, then I can look at, was I selfish in this situation? Oh yeah. Maybe I was trying to get a certain result and I wasn't being respectful of them. Maybe I wasn't really listening. You know, just I'm able, when I'm no longer focused on the other person, God really reveals to me where I'm disconnected from God, where I'm not being kindly and tolerant, even when I feel really justified, especially when I feel really justified. So the resentment inventory is very powerful. And as I go through these columns, these patterns begin to emerge that show me how I've been living my life. Like I get to see the truth. So the fear inventory, I'm almost out of time. So I'm not going to spend too much more time on this. The big book talks about fears being an evil and corroding thread, you know, it talks about just being the fabric of our lives is shot through with it. And that was so true for me. I didn't even realize I was in fear because it was ever present. It was like a fish swimming in water that doesn't even know what water is because it's always around them. So I was steeped in it. It was just my normal. And then at the end of the resentment inventory, one of the sections is about, you know, fears. And that helped me to start to see, oh, I am in fear. And that's actually what's driving a lot of this controlling and judgmental behavior that's coming out. And, you know, long story short, my fears show me where I'm in self-reliance. You know, the big book says, wasn't it because self-reliance failed us? And then it gives me this other option that I never knew was even an option, which is I can rely on God. Like with every time I have a fear, it's an indicator that I'm relying on myself instead of God. So it's like this beautiful invitation to find out how I can invite higher power into more areas of my life. So the third part of the inventory as described in the big book is sex conduct. And this part I feel like is the least talked about. And I have been taught that it can be applied to any relationship. I've been taught that, thank you for that, Amy Jo. So any relationship, I can use this this inventory, but to start with romantic relationships, because they offer a lot of good information. So in the 9-step promises, one of the promises says, we will not regret the past nor wish to shut the door on it. And when I got to the sex conduct inventory, I was just like, oh, I just want to shut the door on this. I do not want to look at this stuff. But I was willing, you know, I had a strong enough first step that I was like, well, what do I have to lose? Let me try it. And so I looked back at my past relationships and, you know, answered certain questions about my conduct there. And what do you know? Patterns began to emerge. Like I saw, like, oh yeah, I was making this relationship my higher power. I was using this person the same way I would use, like I was treating them like a commodity. Like, what can I get from the relationship? Et cetera. So seeing those patterns allows me to see myself. And then it also, and it directs me to write a sex ideal, which I call it, you know, a relationship ideal, relationship conduct ideal, because I can apply it to any relationship. So I write an ideal as an intention and a guideline for how I'm going to behave going forward. And I have written ideals for my marriage. I've written ideals as a parent. I have written ideals as a friend, as a sponsor, as a family member. And so this can be applied anywhere we have relationships. And one of the truths that I hold on to is that any interaction that I have with anybody is an opportunity to learn about myself. And especially when I apply this inventory, this tool of inventory, man, this isn't about uncovering all the horrible things I did and what a bad person I was. This, I get to learn about myself and I get freedom. I don't need to live in that vague place of like, oh, I don't feel so good about this relationship, but I'm not really sure why. And out of the sex conduct inventory, I get to determine, do I owe an amends here? And these were some of my least looked forward to and most powerful amends were ones that came out of this inventory. So I mean, like that's life-changing stuff. And I heard someone say, and I absolutely believe it, or I've experienced it, that when I really did those amends, when I did step 9, my step 2 fell into place. It's like, that's when I really got to know my higher power. And I never would have guessed that. So I have just a couple of minutes to talk about step 5. Why do we have to share this stuff with another person? For me, you know, the big book says we're not going to overcome our disease if we don't. So that's a pretty good motivator. That when I admit it to myself, when I admit it to another person, that's when I really admit it to myself. You know, like I need to say it out loud to someone who gets it, and that I benefit from the perspective of a fellow recovered person, not only because they can help point out things that I might not have seen, they can point out those patterns, but also because it is so valuable to have that experience of being loved and accepted and heard and validated. I mean, my last 5th step I did, I felt so loved. I felt like this is the kind of validation I've been seeking, like from my husband and from other people who can't give it to me because they don't have the same experience. It was so transformational. And I will close. I want to close by reading the 5th step promises, which are in the big book, because I really experienced it this time. It says, once we have taken this step, withholding nothing, we are delighted. We can look the world in the eye. We can be alone at perfect peace and ease. Our fears fall from us. We begin to feel the nearness of our Creator. We may have had certain spiritual beliefs, but now we begin to have a spiritual experience. The feeling that the drink problem has disappeared will often come strongly. We feel that we are on the broad highway, walking hand in hand with the spirit of the universe. And that wasn't always my experience with the 4th step. Sometimes I just felt kind of numb afterwards. I'm sorry, the 5th step. But as I've continued, that has been my experience. And the last thing I want to say is that I didn't do any of this stuff, you know, especially this last round of steps I did. I showed up and I said, God, I'm here with my pen and my paper. I trust that anything that comes out is what you want to come out. And I just let God work through me. And it was such a different experience rather than feeling like I have to figure out what I'm supposed to say. I have to figure out what I'm supposed to write. I have to do it right or I'm going to mess up. And this, the image came to me that this is spiritual surgery, that like, if I go in for a surgical procedure, I have to prepare, you know, I have to like follow the directions. I have to make the appointment. I have to show up at the right time. But once I'm there, I'm not doing it. You know, the doctors, the surgeons are taking care of it. And that's what, you know, the step four, that's what this process is I'm letting God, I'm showing up and I'm saying, okay, God, please do this spiritual surgery on me. And I witness it and I take part in it, but I'm not doing it. And it is like this amazing transformation, God doing for me what I can't do for myself. So I'm out of time. So thank you so much for letting me share. And I just hope that was useful to somebody. And thank you so much for the opportunity to be here.
Priya, thank you so much for sharing your experience, strength, and hope. Really loved what you had to share.